Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
They agreed to rendezvous back at the lakefront in an hour's time, and she's never been seen since. She never returned, and no one knows whatever happened to her.
It's been described as one of New Zealand's most baffling missing persons cases. The disappearance of 36-year-old Heidi Charles, who went missing in Rotorua in 1976 on New Year's Eve. This is Season 5 of Crimes NZ, and I'm Jesse Mulligan. In this podcast, I talk with people about some of New Zealand's most serious crimes. So to tell us about the Heidi Charles case, I'm joined by true crime writer Scott Bainbridge.
Heidi was a German-born woman who travelled all over the world, and she met her husband, who was also a traveller, and they decided in March 1976 to settle in New Zealand. They had two sons aged 8 and 6, and they settled in Wellington, and they'd only been in New Zealand for 9 months, but they evidently, you know, they were, both had secure jobs and growing family and stuff, and then at the end of the year, they decided to travel around New Zealand on holiday in Rotorua. At that time, Heidi had missed her elderly father, and he had arrived in New Zealand only a couple of weeks earlier, so she was, you know, over the moon to spend some time with him. And they planned to camp at on the shores of Lake Rotuiti in Rotorua, and on New Year's Eve, they decided to travel into Rotorua to enjoy the festivities that the town had to hold, and they decided to do some shopping for that night's dinner. They arrived in their camper van around just before midday, and Heidi and Robin, her husband, said to the boys, "Well, you guys go and play in the playground and we'll pick you up in about an hour." But Heidi sort of all of a sudden said to her husband, "Look, I'd like to do the shopping by myself." And so he left her to it, and they agreed to rendezvous back at the lakefront in an hour's time. And she's never been seen since. She never returned, and no one knows whatever happened to her.
When was she last seen?
Well, there was one sighting half an hour after she departed, about 12:30 at a women's clothing store in Tutanakai Street, and then no other sighting. Now, Rotorua New Year's Eve in the afternoon, there were close to about 70,000 people. Mm. So it was, you know, there was a huge throng of people in town, and, she just vanished off the face of the earth. After she was reported missing, there were a number of sightings of somebody fitting her description on the road out of Rotorua and in Aotearoa, which is sort of between Rotorua and Taupo.
When you say on the road, like hitchhiking?
Yeah. Two travellers believe that they saw her hitchhiking along the road. But there's no one came forward to say that they'd picked her up or anything like that. You know, if you compare that to the Mona Blades disappearance a year earlier, you know, Mona had been picked up by a few people and they had come forward. But in this particular case, only a handful of people saw her hitchhiking.
You've described this particular case as very mysterious, Scott.
Yeah, well, look, the 1970s was the era of what they called the motorised offender, where there were a number of girls and women that had been picked up by an offender in a vehicle and, you know, and murdered, and a lot of their cases are unsolved. Now, with this particular one, there was nothing to suggest that she had been murdered, and I know that there were a number of men interviewed in the weeks after her disappearance, including two men from Rotorua that were also interviewed in relation to the Mona Blades disappearance, but those two men had, you know, cast iron alibis, and so they were discounted. Equally, there's nothing to suggest that she had staged her own disappearance, because she seemed, her family believed that she was quite happy. at home, and she had a part-time job, and she was studying, and she was enjoying her life in New Zealand.
When did they raise the alarm, by the way? Was it after she didn't show up for her for that arranged rendezvous?
Yeah, well, after she failed to arrive at 1 o'clock at the van, her husband sort of waited around a bit and collected the boys, and then they drove around the township, all the streets, and no sign of her, and they went into Durant Supermarket where she was supposed to go. Nobody reported, you know, seeing her, anybody of her description. And they made inquiries at the local hospital in case she had an accident, and with the police, and it was towards the end of the day that, you know, they officially reported her missing. In between time, they did go back to the lake camp, and with the possibility that she had become lost and found her own way back to the camp, but no one had seen her.
And how solid is that sighting at 12:30 in the women's clothing store, half an hour before she was meant to be meeting the rest of her family?
Well, she was, the shop assistants described her as, having an accent, and also she was wearing pretty distinctive clothing. So she was wearing sort of bright orange slacks and a striped blue and white T-shirt. And remember, this is the 1970s, so those colours they didn't sort of stick out too much. But they're adamant that, that she did pop in for a few minutes and then leave.
Which also seems to suggest that it wasn't her staging her own disappearance, because, if you leave your husband at midday and you've got an appointment to meet the family back at 1 p.m, you wouldn't think you'd go shopping before staging a disappearance, at least not clothes shopping.
No, that's right. And the police did sort of look at the possibility that she may have staged her own disappearance, but in her handbag back at the camp were her passport and, her purse, and, had she wanted to disappear or go overseas again, she would have obviously needed her passport. Even back in the 70s, where it was reasonably easy to travel in between countries, you still needed a passport.
So did police have any leads at all?
No, none whatsoever. There was, huge publicity drive in the weeks after she disappeared, and there was nothing until probably about the 3 weeks later, at the end of January, that somebody reported a German woman of her description at a shop in Point Chevalier in a takeaways. But that person that made that, reported that sighting, just figured that it was her and that she had been found, and they hadn't kept up with the news. And then it wasn't until it was realised that she was still regarded as missing that that person came forward. But the Auckland police, got that tip off and scoured the streets for a number of days afterwards, but they didn't sort of find her.
They did a bit of a hot pools test. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, for many, many years, there's been that myths that, people fall into the hot pools or the hot geothermal pools, it can break down a body and, people disappear that way. And at the time, the Rotorua police decided to throw the carcass of a sheep into the hot pool, and it just bubbled up to the surface. So that dispelled that myth. But just interesting, just to digress that, I was involved in an investigation of a missing person in Rotorua who disappeared in 1989. And that theory again came up, that on his way home, this chap, Lance Kapoor, would have had to go walk through Kuiro Park, where there are a number of small hot pools. And it was the possibility that he might have fallen into the hot pools, and the hot pools eradicated his body. So as part of the experiment, and with the cooperation of a pathologist, the Rotorua City Council and local iwi, we put the carcass of a recently killed pig into a hot pool, one of the hotter of the pools in Kuiro Park. And the reason why putting a pig in there was the pig makeup is very similar to that of a human. And we monitored that pig in the hot pool for about 2 or 3 days, but it didn't break the body down whatsoever. It certainly, boiled the heck out of it, and it created one heck of a smell too, but it didn't destroy or break down the body at all. So, yeah, that the myth of somebody falling into a hot pool and disappearing that way, that myth was dispelled.
What did her husband make of this? Did he have, did he have any thoughts as to what had happened?
He had no idea, and I know that certainly there were a lot of fingers pointing his way, and he felt that he was the one, obviously being one of the last persons to have seen her, and that he may have been responsible, but he was just as flummoxed as everybody, because he was of the opinion that, you know, everything was okay, and she had seemed a little bit stressed because prior to her disappearance, because she was having to act as a translator or interpreter for her elderly father and his partner, who were over, and it was just sort of taking its toll. But he had no rhyme or reason as to why she disappeared. And a lot of people that do know her and people that I've talked to, you know, recall that, you know, she was a doting mum, you know, and she had two young boys and they were the world to her. And, you know, there was just no reason as to why she'd leave them, not make any contact.
So let's have a look at what else was going on in the 1970s. Could there have been any connection to other cases of this type around then?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, there were a number of women that had fallen prey to motorised offenders. Each one of those had different suspects, and I believe the police would have looked at those at the time. But you know, there was nothing really that stood out. And certainly, like, if you could, as I say, compare it to Mona Blades and Jennifer Beard, Jennifer Beard was found, but police realised, you know, reasonably early on that Mona was probably murdered. With Heidi, it was less obvious. Also, if she was abducted, it would have been, you know, it was in the middle of the day in front or among so many people. It would have, something would have stood out there. It's just a pure mystery. And you know, I've known about this case for many years, and I did discuss it at length back in the 1980s with the detective that was involved with both that one and Mona Blades, the late Ned Ryan. And even he said that, you know, he changed his mind every so often as to whatever happened to her, whether she was killed or whether she staged her own disappearance. Certainly she did have, I did say that her purse was found at the camp, but it was known that she had a reasonable amount of money on her. She had $200 in cash, and in 1976 that was, I'm not sure what the conversion was, but it was probably worth a couple of thousand in today's denominations. But her elderly father had given her $200 as well, so she was carrying around a significant sum of money. But you know, any thought of her staging her own disappearance wasn't really taken too seriously, because you know, she'd only been in the country for 9 months, and she didn't know anybody outside her immediate family and some of the family that she, you know, lived around in Wellington. She certainly wouldn't have known anybody in Rotorua. So it's just a complete mystery. And the police did look at the time at the airport records to see if, not so much her, but if she may have had a different name, changed a different name and got a different passport, which would have been reasonably easy at that time to obtain a fraudulent passport. But there was nothing that stood out, you know, any similarities, with names.
You mentioned Mona Blades a couple of times. For people who are not familiar with, what are the bare facts of that case?
Well, it was Queen's birthday weekend, it's a public holiday, in 1975, which was about 18 months before Heidi disappeared. And Mona was on her way to visit family down in Hastings, and she left Hamilton in the morning. And she got picked up several times hitchhiking, but the last sighting was just outside Taupo. And she was seen as a passenger in an orange Datsun station wagon that was seen diverting down Martia Road, which is a side road between Napier and Taupo. And the car had been parked up, and very shortly afterwards, that car, you know, returned on its way, and Mona's never been seen again. But it's believed that Mona was murdered by the man in that orange Datsun station wagon.
Yeah. And that's pretty close geographically to Heidi 18 months later. Is it your feeling that the two might be connected?
I had thought that, but having talked to the detective involved and other people, I would say not. The only similarity really is, as you say, it was in the same kind of region. It was a public holiday, and they were both hitchhiking. But the police were at that stage were pretty certain that they had the suspect for they knew the suspect of Mona's disappearance, and he had died. Although in recent years another person has come to light.
Mm.
I don't know whether or not he's been interviewed in regards to Heidi's disappearance.
Mm. When you say they were both hitchhiking, that's if we're to believe that sighting. Someone saw her on the way out of Rotorua. How solid was that sighting?
Oh, they were pretty solid. They came forward not long after it was publicised, and the people had given a lot more detail, particularly around the clothing that she wore. And that sort of spurred police to give it some credence that the sightings were genuine.
Okay. I also just want to mention a possible, I think this has been ruled out, but a possible connection with the notorious Australian serial killer, Ivan Milat.
Yeah, well, Ivan Milat, yeah, he, a mass murderer from Australia. You know, he was convicted in the late 90s, I think, or it might have been the early 2000s, of a number of murders of a number of backpackers over in Australia. And when his crimes came to light and they delved in a bit more into his background to see whether or not he was responsible for any more, it was learned that he was living in New Zealand between April 1971 and April 1974. So police, senior detectives sort of got together to have a look at the files to see, you know, who, if there were any women that were missing or were murdered, and their cases remained unsolved in, you know, in that time. But in between that time, there were 1971 and 1974, there were very few murders in New Zealand, and of those, they were all solved. So there was no sort of outstanding unsolved murder that they could attribute to him. And when he was in New Zealand, Milat had escaped Australia because he'd, you know, committed a reasonably big bank robbery, and he was on the run. So he lay low for the time that he was here, just picking up you know, labouring jobs here and there, but certainly there were no serious crimes attributed to him during his stay here.
And what's the story right now with the police investigation, with the police case? Where is it at?
Well, like anything, any old case where the leads dry up, I guess it's still regarded as an open case. I don't believe that it's gone to a coronial hearing. I guess, you know, the police are just waiting for any information, but we're talking an awful long time ago now. I originally wrote about the case in my very first missing person book called Without Trace, and shortly afterwards, when that came out, I received a number of calls. A lot of them were, you know, oddball theories, but, you know, it was, there were two gentlemen that did contact me, respective of each other, and they both knew the Charles families respectively in Wellington in the 1970s, and they were in the Boy Scouts with Heidi's sons, and, you know, both of them at different times, you know, told me that, you know, we heard, you know, Mr. Charles say to one of the boys, you know, if you don't do as you're told, I'll do what I did to your mum. So, you know, casting sort of light on the possibility that Robin Charles murdered his wife. And I raised that with Alex Charles, that's Heidi and Robin's eldest son, and he scoffed and laughed at the suggestion. He said that, look, it's just absolutely not true at all. It was probably taken out of context, but he said, you know, they really had a hard time growing up because, you know, not only the publicity around the case and, I guess, fingers pointed at their dad, but, you know, it was hard for the family. Robin was slightly older when Heidi gave birth, and, you know, he all of a sudden had to become, you know, mum and dad to his boys as they grew up. And Alex did tell me that, they grew up, you know, in a loving family environment, and Robin did a fantastic job bringing them up.
So what's your personal theory?
That changes all the time. You know, when I first delved into it, I was of the belief that Heidi was murdered. You know, and she was picked up by, you know, hitchhiking, and she was picked up and she was murdered. But the more I think about it, I do struggle with that sometimes. Any abduction would have had to have been spontaneous and in a busy public area. When she was last seen, would have been spotted, I think. And obviously, unless, you know, she did get killed by somebody that picked her up hitchhiking. But, you know, equally, she could have easily have started up. She may have had a secret life, you know, where she had met somebody else, and they decided to, you know, to go off and have a new life. But that equally, I find that hard to believe because, you know, if she was a loving mother, as she's portrayed to be, she, you know, she would have made contact at some time with her sons, even if it was, you know, years later. And when I talked to Alex, you know, he said, look, they've, you know, heard absolutely nothing, you know, in that time. It's a huge mystery.
Do you think there's any chance the case will ever be solved?
I don't think so. Unless you know somebody has a deathbed confession, or if Heidi is alive herself, you know, she comes forward, and also
or if they find the body,
yeah. And you know, and that's happened before, where you know missing people have been found years and years later. Look at you know, Jane Furlong, you know, her body was found sort of over 20 years after she disappeared. But when you go back through the statistics of, you know, the newspapers, when they bring up cases of people that have been missing, presumed murdered, Heidi's case is never mentioned. So, you know, why is that? You know, you'd think that it would have had as much publicity today as Mona Blades would, because, yeah, any little news about Mona Blades makes, you know, front page news, yet... you know, Heidi was probably never afforded, certainly after, you know, that the leads died down, she was never afforded the publicity that her case should have had.
You've been listening to Crimes NZ with me, Jesse Mulligan. You can find more episodes of this series on the RNZ podcast page. It's also on Apple, Spotify, iHeart, or wherever you catch your favourite podcasts. Follow the series. It'll mean you won't miss an episode. And if you're looking for your next podcast fix, try Let's Be Transparent, an insight into gender transition from a young man and his mum who've recently navigated the process. And I'm on RNZ each afternoon from 1 to 4pm with an upbeat mix of New Zealand stories from the curious to the compelling. You can find our show on RNZ National.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.